This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, East Africa, a region where political instability and insurgency has gone on for decades. Not just from the Islamist violence of Al-Shabaab, but also conflict among internal political factions in some of the nations in the region. The net result is continued bloodshed for the people of East Africa, a major hindrance to growth and progress. Meanwhile, the international community wants to ensure access to and safety in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean, so petroleum and other commerce could move between Europe and Asia. Speaking of commerce, one foreign power, China, has spent recent years creating a very visible presence in the region and reinforcing it by building infrastructure and providing other significant assistance. Altruism, or perhaps a canny strategy to become a dominant influence beyond the commercial realm. Hello again. I'm VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Encounter's regular host, Carol Castiel. With us to discuss the security and economic situation in East Africa are two very experienced veterans of that region, Ambassador David Shin and the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program Director, Judd Devermont. Welcome to VOA Encounter.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
We have significant developments in just recent time. On Sunday evening, May 23rd, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken issued a statement imposing a new round of restrictions and sanctions focused not just at Ethiopia, but at Eritrea and also at the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF. There were, in the announcement, visa restrictions on officials from Ethiopia, both current and former. There is also restrictions on anyone connected with the TPLF. They've also, in this statement, indicated that they are imposing wide-ranging restrictions on economic and security assistance to Ethiopia. And the statement says, and will bring our defense trade control policy in line with them. However, we will continue humanitarian assistance. And the statement goes on to say the United States will continue its existing broad restrictions on assistance to Eritrea. Well, obviously, it did not take Addis Ababa very much time to respond, and it did. In a press statement released on Monday, May 24th, the Ethiopian government says this decision came at a time when the Ethiopian government has been engaging positively and constructively with the U.S. administration on issues of common concern. It also sends, according to the statement, a wrong signal at a time when Ethiopia is gearing up to hold national elections, which is expected to usher in a new political dispensation in the country. We can go on with the Ethiopian statement. It obviously objects to what Secretary Blinken is doing. I would like to turn it over to you and get your assessments. Ambassador Shin, what do you think first of what Secretary of State Blinken has issued and also Addis's response?
Well, these are both very hard-hitting statements. There is not a great deal left to the imagination coming from either Ethiopia or the United States. I think that it may set in motion a possible series of steps that over the short term anyway, could result in a reassessment of the relationship on both sides of the ocean. At a minimum, it's going to cause a lot of consternation in Addis Ababa and in Washington. And it remains to be seen how far this will go. And in the long run, the Ethiopia-U.S. relationship is solid, it's longstanding, and it will be maintained. But over the short term, even medium term, there could be some real bumps in the road.
There was a statement put out by a publication called the Ethiopian Monitor, and it said that Ethiopia will not sit down and negotiate with TPLF as Western countries continue to exert effort to resuscitate the organization, which lawmakers labeled as a terrorist entity. The statement came a day after the U.S. called the parties involved with the conflict to take no meaningful steps to end hostilities or pursue a peaceful resolution. So this statement, at least by the Ethiopian Monitor, says that Addis will not even talk to TPLF. Mr. Devermont, weigh in on this, please.
Well, I think the statement really twists the U.S. position. The U.S. position is not
to renew or rejuvenate or revive the TPLF. The U.S. position is consistent that we need to have a dialogue to end the mass atrocities, the violence, to open up humanitarian access. And the former ruling party, the TPLF, is a party to the conflict and has to be engaged to address the human suffering. And maybe, Jeff, just to pull back a little bit, this is a long time in coming. You know, the conflict has been raging for more than 6 months. The U.S. has engaged with Addis Ababa frequently, has sent Senator Coons, named an envoy, I think has been patient with all of the combatants to find a way out of this before pulling the trigger on sanctions and some other restrictions. And, you know, I think it's about time to escalate some of the pressure, in part because nothing is getting better. And I agree with Ambassador Shin that it does mean that we're going to have some friction in the relationship. But I don't think the U.S. or the international community can stand idly by when we're seeing the level of atrocities that are unfolding in this part of the country.
People always talk about carrots and sticks. You can look at this by Secretary Blinken. Someone could say that's a stick. Has the U.S. offered any carrots to Ethiopia? Have there been any enticements to perhaps resolve this? What has the U.S. put forth to all parties involved here?
Yeah, the United States has made very clear that it will continue to offer humanitarian assistance to Ethiopia. I underscored that point again in the most recent statement by Secretary Blinken. I'm not aware of any new carrots that have been offered, with a possible exception that the U.S. position on the whole Nile waters question and the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has been, I think, fairly carefully calculated so as not to offend Ethiopia, more so than in the previous administration. Whether you consider that a carrot or not, I don't know. If I could just underscore one point that Judd made, which is very important, and that is on the issue of equating the sort of the TPLF with what the United States is trying to do here, I think is a very unfortunate in terms of Ethiopia's position. They're seeing any opposition to their policy in Addis Ababa as being support for the TPLF. And that's just not the issue at hand anymore. The U.S. is not supporting the TPLF. They're trying to end the conflict in Tigray. That's very, very different.
There's a line in the statement put forth by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ethiopia that says, there is nothing more revealing than this to understand the misguided approach by the administration, referring to the Biden administration, that sense of equating the two of them. But that's a very provocative line in the statement from Addis Ababa.
Correct. That is, I think, an indication of a misread of what the Biden administration is trying to do.
Please, Mr. Devermont, join in.
I would just add that over the past 6 months, the U.S. has engaged Addis Ababa and asked for more humanitarian access, and the government has been very limited in doing that. The U.S. government has asked for the Ethiopians to ask the Eritreans to leave Tigray, and even though they said that they would do that, that has not happened. So, you know, the Ethiopian statement of friendship and partnership, the U.S. has been there, working very diligently and patiently to sort of address these things through this bilateral channel. And I think it's a matter of frustration that has led the U.S. to say, we don't know if you are going to deliver on any of the pledges that you have made to us and to the international community.
Let's move to a broader look at the security situation in all of East Africa, the Horn, and the other countries in the region. Could you please give me, Mr. Devermont, a situation report, a small encapsulation? We know that al-Shabaab is active and violent. What are the other non-state actors in the region that are causing instabilities?
Well, first, let's start, Jeff, with Ethiopia, because Ambassador Shin and I have spent our time talking about Tigray, but that is not the only hotspot within Ethiopia. There's violence in Beni Shangul, Gamuz. There's violence in Oromia region. There's violence on several of the regional states' borders. So it's a much bigger problem than just Tigray, although that's the most acute. Then zooming out further, there is instability in Somalia from al-Shabaab. That has been there for a long time. But an impasse on the political trajectory of this country around elections, that led to violence in Mogadishu by supporters of the opposition. that is now, I wouldn't say it's back on track, but at least they're talking again. And the president has retracted his commitment to stay in power for another 2 years. There is violence between the Ethiopians and the Sudanese on the border. There has been a resurgence of violence in Darfur, in Western Sudan. And then there is constant fighting still in South Sudan between various communities and armed groups. So when you look at this region, most of these countries have various levels of insecurity, some more pressing than others, but all of them causing human misery and displacement.
Ambassador Shin, and we have U.S. AFRICOM active in the region. What can and should the U.S. do in this region to help support and maintain security?
Well, traditionally, AFRICOM's strength has been in its training function. But that, of course, is dependent upon having a good cordial relationship with the various countries in the region. And if you are having problems developing that relationship, it's going to be very hard to continue the training function. In addition to AFRICOM's engagement more generally in the region based out of Stuttgart in Germany, you, of course, have the combined task force Horn of Africa operation at Camp Ammonier in Djibouti. So you have a U.S. military facility in Djibouti with about 4,000 personnel in it. It has been there primarily engaged in counterterrorism activity, particularly that which has happened in both Somalia and Yemen across the Gulf of Aden. So that does contribute to stability in the region. But the situation that you have in Ethiopia today does not really much lend itself to U.S. security engagement inside the country, particularly if the relationship is on a bumpy road.
Let me ask you this. What should the role of the African Union and other Pan-African organizations be regarding supporting and maintaining security in the region? Should it be their responsibility? Whose responsibility is it for security in East Africa?
Well, that's a good question. And there are those who would argue that in the first instance, it's the responsibility of the United Nations and its peacekeeping capacity. Increasingly, that responsibility has been shared with the African Union. And you had a hybrid African Union UN operation in Darfur and Sudan, for example. And you had the African Union totally in charge in Somalia, still is. So it's a very mixed situation today. The African Union has been willing to step up to a much greater extent in the last 10 years than it was previously. But it is a shared responsibility between the UN and the African Union.
Mr. Devermont, what are your thoughts on Pan-African involvement?
No, I think Ambassador Shin is exactly right. The African Union has been pretty robustly engaged here. I mean, starting with the African Union's mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM, which has been critical to weakening al-Shabaab. Of course, al-Shabaab remains a serious threat, but they were important in pushing out that terrorist group from some of the major cities. And I don't think we should underplay the efforts by the African Union to push for negotiations and peace. But the actor that we haven't talked about is the countries themselves, the governments and the combatants. So, for example, the African Union recently appointed former Ghanaian President John Mahama to negotiate the peace process in Somalia around the impasse around the elections, and he was rejected by the Somali actors. So that's an instance where their good offices were unwanted. There has been efforts by President Tshisekedi to build on his predecessor as the head of the AU, Cyril Ramaphosa, to deal with the GERD. And I think Ambassador Shin would agree that they've made some progress in terms of addressing some of the technical problems. The political problems still persist. And then the African Union had a partnership with the UN in Darfur, although that mission is closing. So I think that they're important, but ultimately they, just like the US and the UN, add pressure, perhaps help train, perhaps help think through alternative processes to get to peace. But ultimately, the combatants, the belligerents, the state-level actors are going to have to believe it's in their interest to make peace.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America, discussing East Africa's insurgencies, political inclusion, and economic development. Our Ambassador David Shin and CSIS Africa Program Director Judd Devermont. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook, Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal listener, Edem Adelete from Accra, Ghana. If you would like to have your name and country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now let's get back to our program on the situation in East Africa. Let's talk about economic development, especially the presence and influence of China. Beijing has in recent years embarked on substantial programs of building infrastructure in East Africa. Some have accused China of mercantilism, a situation by which a government is influenced to act in ways directly beneficial to certain entities. Ambassador Shin, give us your assessment of China's presence, involvement, and most importantly, its ulterior motives in East Africa. What are they doing?
Well, I would agree that it's accurate to refer to what China is doing throughout Africa, in addition to the Horn of Africa, as mercantilism. And I would make the same argument, quite frankly, for quite a number of other countries who engage in the same practice. The difference with China has been particularly the degree to which it is engaged in building infrastructure projects throughout the continent, including East Africa. But it's doing this through loans primarily, and not always loans that are offered by China. Many of the loans come from the World Bank, the African Development Bank. They're paid for by the governments in the African countries themselves. And then Chinese companies win the contract. They have a track record for operating in the region. Their pricing tends to be lower than most other companies. So they win an enormous amount of these contracts. But they do offer a significant number of loans that are not being offered by other countries for the most part. So they're playing a major role on that score alone, in addition to all of the traditional areas that they're involved in, like trade and foreign direct investment and security activity.
Now I'd like to get Judd Devermont's perspectives on China's East African presence and activities. How do you see it?
I think what China is doing is both economic, it serves their own economic needs. They have a sort of a saturated and mature construction industry, and they need to push that out. And that has been, I think, the part of the story of the BRI. It's also, though, been about sort of global network, being able to have relationships across the region. It's also security. As you mentioned earlier, Jeff, there is a base that they have in Djibouti, which both helps them deal with piracy off the coast of the Horn of Africa, but also gives them power projection. So the answer isn't one or the other, it's all of the above. And I think what's challenging for US or a foreign audience is to be able to unpick and unpack what is what. And it's quite difficult because they're often very blended.
What I find very interesting, when China built its new marine facility in Djibouti, I have looked at it on Google Earth, and it's very obvious that the facility that China built is right next to Camp Lemonnier, which is where we have UAVs flying to and from. And it's interesting because when the UAVs take off, they start spewing out data. And of course, we're monitoring that data. That's how we fly them, and that's how we use them. And the beauty of China's base being right next to, just right above the runway practically, is that all the telemetry coming from the UAVs is also being downloaded by the Chinese right there on the spot. Rather amazing.
Certainly can't disagree with that. At the same time, Djibouti is a very small place. There are not a lot of options for locating a military base. So you're probably going to be fairly close to the American base, almost irrespective of what location you finally opt for. I think that's an added benefit to China of their military base. I don't think it was one of the principal reasons for going into Djibouti in the first place. I think they wanted to use it for power projection, for basically supporting their three-ship task force that is constantly rotating in and out of the anti-piracy operation in the Gulf of Aden, and for protecting Chinese personnel and interests throughout the Horn of Africa and the Middle East, which it has done on several occasions, including the evacuation of Chinese nationals from Yemen.
I think we do a disservice, Jeff, when we just talk about China and the U.S. and Africa. So if you take Djibouti, there is a French base. There is an Italian base. There's a Japanese base. The Saudis are building a base. And apparently the Indians are looking to put a base on the Japanese base. So this is hot real estate. It's because the Bab el-Mandeb Straits is 12 to 20% of maritime commerce. So it's not surprising, as Ambassador Shin said, that China wants to be there. But they're not the only ones who covet this particular piece of land.
Could it be argued that China's largesse, their willingness to build infrastructure and make investments and give loans, et cetera, looked at it's kind of like going to the loan shark? And eventually a country gets itself so in debt that it may be in a position where China, let's say, can influence a country by saying, you know, as a matter of fact, we own a heck of a lot of your debt. And what would you like to do about it? Is this too cynical to look at this in that sort of a way?
Well, it's not too cynical in that effectively that happened in Sri Lanka with a port facility there that China eventually obtained a 99-year lease on. Sri Lanka went into default. The problem with the argument, though, is that China has many levers for leverage in Africa and elsewhere, not just the building up of loans and debt, et cetera. The issue becomes, even though you have these levers and even though you may be in a position to extract something for them, you have to be pretty careful how you play your hand on that. Otherwise, the governments that are impacted, in this case, the African governments, become very sensitive to pressure from outside. And they're not going to take lightly to the idea of being told they have to give up something or turn over something to China because they are delinquent on their debt. I think that would go down very badly in Africa. And I think China will learn that lesson very fast if it decides to go that route.
What's your thought, Mr. Debrabant?
Yeah, I think the debt trap diplomacy argument, which you've laid out for us, is a very unhelpful one. The facts are that China does hold debt in many African countries, but it's about 20% of African debt. The biggest holder of African debt is actually commercial lenders. But there are countries where that debt is significant. In Zambia, for example, in Angola. So we should be looking at Chinese debt specific to the countries where that debt is significant. And then as Ambassador Shin said, what we've seen in most cases is that the Chinese have been much more willing to restructure that debt rather than to keep it going if the Africans can't meet the terms of lending. I'm particularly careful about this argument because it's not very helpful when we make it because there's some fact problems with it, but also the Africans react very negatively to it. And the truth is, China doesn't have to spend a lot of money in terms of loans to get some of the things that it wants from Africans globally. They care about African votes at the Security Council. African countries hold 3 Security Council seats. They care about African votes at the UN General Assembly. They're the largest and most unified bloc. And 25-something countries have been supporting the Chinese on whether it's Hong Kong or Shenzhen. So they haven't had to pull the rug from under them on debt to get the kind of compliance that they're looking for in these multilateral institutions.
One thing that I have noticed from the limited time that I've had in Africa, Africa is much, much closer to Europe than Asia is. And what I noticed when I was in Nigeria was that there was a tremendous potential for value-added industry that wasn't being done. And I look at East Africa, and you see its proximity, the Gulf of Aden and the Suez Canal and Europe. And instead of something being manufactured way off in Asia and taking weeks and weeks on a freighter to even make it to the Gulf of Aden, let alone Europe, if value-added industries, if that kind of economic development could be built up in East Africa, why couldn't East Africa be the value-added process shipping to Europe instead of just the transit point from Asia to Europe? It would seem to me that that sort of development is really the key to the African century that the continent wants.
Your argument is very logical, and one day that may happen. The short-term problem is that infrastructure in Africa is still woefully behind that of Asian countries, for example, where it's much more efficient. And the Asian countries, not just China, but India, Vietnam, Bangladesh, are able to undersell most African products that have value added because they're simply more efficient with their infrastructures. But one day that will change.
Do you have a thought on that, Mr. Debrabant?
No, I mean, I think that is right. The continent needs between $130 and $170 billion worth of infrastructure investments per year, according to the African Development Bank. So they're not in a position to compete right now with other regions. I'm an optimist about eventual ability to do so, and particularly with the free trade agreement that the Africans have signed, uniting 53 countries plus Western Sahara in one of the biggest free trade areas outside the WTO. And working on regional trade will be one way to really get things going.
This wraps up this edition of the UA Encounter. Our guests covering East Africa have been Ambassador David Shin and Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa Program Director Judd Devermont. Many thanks for your insights and perspectives. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Join us next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.